ましょう。
Blog Talk Radio。
Welcome to Midwrap, where the Navy Mil Blog community's top bloggers discuss the latest developments, long-term trends, and the way forward for the Navy Marine Corps team and all things American.
And welcome, everybody, to episode 17 of Midrats. This week's topic is Homeland Security. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, with my host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Our guest today will be talking about Homeland Security. We're going to give you two points of view. We have our resident expert and fellow USNI blogger, Jim Dolbeau, I always mispronounce his name, who will be giving us kind of the Coast Guard perspective as our last line of defense on Homeland Defense and where they actually stand in 2010, because their mission has changed a lot since many of us grew up with the Coast Guard. And our second guest today will be Mark Stenovich, and he's going to give us more of the consequence management point of view of Homeland Defense, as I like to say, when the next attack, not if the next attack takes place. So kick back and enjoy yourself. And whether you're joining us live or you're getting the archive from Blog Talk Radio or downloading the podcast from iTunes, we really appreciate you taking the time out to talk about things that we like to talk about here. For those of us listening live, make sure and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. We've got the chat room up and running with already the usual suspects raising a ruckus. If you have some questions or things you want to bring in during the show, we'll have Eagle One, Ride and Herd, as usual, on the chat room. Our first guest, as I mentioned before, is Jim Dolbeau. He is a writer and blogger for both the USNI blog and the Coast Guard blog.org. He's a Coast Guard Reserve officer and former defense staffer on Capitol Hill. He has served as a legislative director and military legislative assistant for Congressman Jim Hostetler, Indiana, and also a legislative director for the Conservative Action Teams and legislative assistant for Representative Jim Runyon in Kansas. In his U.S. Coast Guard Reserve responsibilities, he has served as a SAR control officer, and he's also recalled to active duty for Operation Noble Eagle. He served as a watchstander for the Joint Operations Command Center in Washington, D.C. He's been a Harbor Patrol team leader and post-Hurricane Katrina operations experience. He served as the legislative affairs analyst on the staff of the principal federal official, Admiral Tad W. Allen, U.S. Coast Guard. He holds a B.S. in political science from Marymount University and a Master's of Art in National Security and Strategic Studies from Naval War College. And he wasn't content with having one. He also decided to get a Master's of Statecraft and World Politics from the Institute of World Politics in Washington, D.C. He works on national defense and homeland security issues, and his work has appeared in both Proceedings, the Washington Post, Washington Times, Sea Power, National Defense, Navy Times, Armed Forces Journal, International, just to name a few. Jim, welcome to Midrats.
Glad to be on board. Thank you so much for having me. Hopefully that didn't bore too many people.
Hey, we bore people every week. You're in good company. Hey, this is our first chance, really, to and we've gone too long without bringing the Coast Guard on board, just like we did an episode a few weeks ago with the where we focused on the Marine Corps, because you know, here at Midrats, we really like to focus on maritime security issues and everybody that has a big play in that. And I think as a maritime professional, everybody's familiar with the Coast Guard, but I think a lot of people's perspective of the Coast Guard and what they bring to the homeland security and homeland defense standpoint in 2010 really isn't fleshed out that well. A lot of that's due to the fact that if you're looking from a strictly Navy point of view, we talk about sea blindness. Nobody wants to talk about, you know, big Navy doing big Navy things. And I think Coast Guard and their critical role in homeland security also suffers a little bit from that blindness with all the attention going on to ground operations. So if you could, for a second, just give us a real broad snapshot of post 9/11. How is the Coast Guard not just bureaucratically restructured, but how they've kind of recentered their mission and their primary concern to carry out what they've been asked to do by the SINC?
Okay, great question. I'm going to start off with the bureaucratic standpoint. Pre-9/11, I was working on Capitol Hill, and I remember the Coast Guard's budget was like in the $4 billion, the $4.5 billion range. And we're like thinking, sure, it would be nice to have that budget doubled. Well, lo and behold, it's doubled, but the Coast Guard still has so many readiness woes in that it's got a geriatric fleet out of the world's top 39 Coast Guards. It's got like the 36th or 37th oldest fleet because, I mean, they just retired a cutter last year that first served. That was first chased U-boats in the Atlantic during World War II. So we've seen an inflow of cash, but the readiness woes and the personnel costs have, you know, negated the increases in readiness that should come with that because the Coast Guard went through a three-decade procurement holiday. You know, in the DOD, they always talk about the procurement holiday of the 90s. Well, Coast Guard went 34 years in between commissioning a large cutter, and they're paying the price for it today. And with a scene in Haiti, like 10 out of the 12 cutters that were on scene in Haiti had engine problems, fires, mishaps, just because of their aging inventory of platforms. So Coast Guard is at the forefront of a new cabinet department, the lead operational agency, but still many readiness concerns remain.
Eagle One.
Jim, this is Eagle One. Talk a little bit about the National Defense, or whatever they call it, the new cutter that is supposed to kind of pick up the slack. When does that look like any of those might come online?
Now, it's the National Security Cutter. Bartol was commissioned in, I believe it was August 4th, 2008. The second ship that's cutter coming online is the Weishi, named after the commandant of the Coast Guard during World War II and the first four-star admiral of the Coast Guard. That's being commissioned on May 7th of this year in Alameda, California. There's a total of eight. With those eight, they're replacing 12 high-endurance cutters, so it's not on a one-for-one basis. And the problem, in my view, with the Coast Guard's modernization program, it was baselined on a pre-9/11 world. And none of the requirements for it have changed. I mean, I would argue that since 9/11, we should not go from 12 high endurance cutters down to eight national security cutters. I mean, I've written before on cgblog.org that, you know, we should have a national security cutter sail with every carrier strike group and every expeditionary strike group. So that there would increase the buy to another 22 national security cutters. Now, I've been on board. I toured the Bertoff, and I haven't gone out to sea on it. It's a nice ship. It's like the Cadillac of the fleet, given that the rest of the fleet are, you know, antiques now.
Well, Sal here. I had your first. First couple minutes you were talking, you know, you mentioned that U.S. Coast Guard budget went from $4 billion to $8 billion since 9/11, but we still have an incredibly old fleet, and we're not doing a one-for-one replacement. So the immediate question that comes to mind is, what in God's creation did we do with the double money? Is the Coast Guard, I know there was some problem with the whole deep water concept, Did the Coast Guard run into a similar problem that the Navy ran into, where everything went Tiffany and everything just got too expensive to really be able to get the number of holes displacing water that you needed?
That's one of the reasons. And also the health care costs, like, you know, the TRICARE, increased personnel costs, all ate that up. And also they were trying to buy back, you know, all the years of neglect and funding, you know, by patching up past readiness needs, and that ate up a lot of the money. But, yeah, I mean, some, you know, for a Coast Guard cutter to design it to take 6-8 years, yeah, I mean, there's some gold plating going on. And now, you know, we're also looking at the icebreaker. We need some new icebreakers. And they're talking about taking 10 years from the time to design it to its operating is 10 years. And I'm like, that's 2.5 times the length of the U.S. involvement in World War II. And your question brings up, you know, one of my favorite questions and it causes some people heartburn, is I believe that the Navy and Coast Guard should work together more and more on a common hull. I don't know what that one is, but instead of building like 3 different types of cutters and 2 different types of certain surface combatants, can we neck down the number of different ship types and have a common hull between the two for economies of scale, if nothing else?
Eagle One?
I have a couple of questions. One has to do with the way the Coast Guard approaches homeland security. If you were to work from the outer zone of the Coast Guard area responsibility and work your way inward to where I assume we would put port security units, how is that structured? What does the shell look like for that?
We have long range aircraft. You got cutters deployed. You got your Coast Guard small boat stations that are littered throughout, up and down the coast, and like the rest of DOD, Coast Guard wants to play away games for this. I mean, you know, if we're fighting terrorists in a port, in any port in the U.S., that's not good.
And the second question is asked by one of the people in the chat room is, how have the post-9/11 changes affected the effectiveness or efficiency of the Coast Guard's traditional duties?
They're still, you know, the world's best search and rescue organization. I mean, it hasn't impacted that. Now, and that's always been a concern of a lot of members of Congress, is that, you know, the Coast Guard gets new missions, but they don't want to have it impact search and rescue. I mean, the Coast Guard's multi-mission, multi-talented agency, so they're able to do that. Some of the missions I have taken a backseat are like bridge administration. Some of the regulatory missions probably, you know, have not been undertaken as much, and some of the fisheries management, because you got search and rescue, the Coast Guard's national defense mission, because don't forget there's 6 cutters over in Iraq. There's been some small number of Coast Guardsmen in Afghanistan, and the Coast Guard's contributions to the drug war in the Southcom's AOR makes it another theater, just given the targets of opportunity and the drug runners and all that. So the Coast Guard hasn't neglected the search and rescue mission. They have had to pull back the throttle on several other missions like the fisheries.
Jim, when we look at just from an East Coast point of view, when you get a bunch of JOs together and you throw down a few beers and you invite them to put on their red hat, it seems within 5 minutes everybody comes up with the, you know, thank goodness I'm not them. There's the classic Norfolk at Christmas scenario. There's when you're coming into Mayport, it has the shortest sea and anchor detail in the U.S. Navy. You look at where our submarines are up in the Northeast, that because our naval forces, if you look at it just from a protecting our Navy point of view, our inland waterways, they share with both the commercial and the military. You can't have a perfect cordon sanitaire around all of your military assets, because then you'll have no trade, no recreation on the waters. That's always been a concern, but especially since post 9/11, when everybody goes through their various scenarios about how our naval assets could be attacked. What is the touchiest part from the Coast Guard point of view, because you deal more with civilian law enforcement and maritime commercial entities, to draw that line between trying to make sure that we can secure our critical assets while still not interfering with commerce and free use of the inland waterways? Just, we'll use the Chesapeake for an example.
Wow, that's a good question. What I'm qualified to talk about would be, you mentioned, you were right on target when you mentioned that fine balance about maritime commerce. I mean, if a ship is 15, 20 minutes late leaving a port, that costs them thousands and thousands of dollars. So, and we saw a few years ago when there was a strike at a port, I think it was L.A. Long Beach, and, you know, the port was shut down for a few days, what impact that had on the rest of the country, since all of our, given our trade imbalance, that everything is just-in-time delivery, you know, a port that's shut down for one reason or another can have a ripple effect across the entire country. So you have to strike the balance. Of course, national defense would trump commerce, but, you know, you can do both, I believe, protect both of them. I mean, it would be a lot easier if there were more Coast Guardsmen on the force. I've written, co-wrote a paper with Heritage Foundation a few years ago that recommended doubling the size of the Coast Guard to about 80,000, given that we have 360 ports and 95,000 miles of waterways. Right now, Coast Guard is about the same size as the New York City Police Force.
How does your interface work with the Customs and Border Protection Forces? Where do y'all draw the line between this is the Coast Guard's water space, so to speak, and here's where we turn over to Customs and Border Protection? And is there any redundancy there, or do you feel like they've done a pretty job of efficiently outlining responsibilities?
I don't have any operational experience with Customs. I just know sometimes people have remarked that DHS is going to have more navies and more air forces than DOD real soon, because Customs has their own fleet of boats and aircraft. But what I can speak on, that my going on 8 years with Coast Guard and following them another 4 years on Capitol Hill, they are great at interagency cooperation. They are, to me, they set the gold standard for it. So I don't see much of a problem with the interface between the two. If anything, probably the Coast Guard would detain people, and while Customs would arrest them, because, you know, that's less paperwork for the Coast Guard to do.
Eagle One.
Well, because of the size of the Coast Guard, you all seem to be exceptionally, I don't know if dependent is the right word, but you work so hard with your auxiliary. How much of a role do they play in law enforcement? Are they mostly taking care of some of the missions that the active duty can't because of the just the shortage of active duty personnel?
They can't arrest people like active duty Coast Guardsmen can do, but they do a lot of the boating safety lectures in the classroom. They also are out on the water with their own fleet of boats, doing safety checks. I've seen them stand watches in command centers. I've seen one guy, he was the command duty officer for the weekend, you know, one weekend a month. There are thousands of them. They're, you know, in every Coast Guard concentration area around the country, and the Coast Guard couldn't do its mission without them. This year, I mean, this week is like the 68th anniversary of Admiral Ernest King tasking, who was the Navy CNO at the time, getting the Coast Guard Auxiliary organized to track the German U-boats on the East Coast. So they've got a great history, and God bless every one of them because they do it for as a volunteer. And they also burn up a lot of their own gas and fuel at their own expense.
Being that I know a lot of the concern that the Coast Guard has is with ships coming from overseas to here, and I know there's been a lot of work, really for decades, but especially for the last decade, of working with other nations' Coast Guards and their equivalent to get that security at each the terminal at each end, so to speak. And I don't know whether you're familiar with the two articles that a regular here, Jerry Hendricks, has written. One was as by Ford's, not Ferrari, and Les Henderson, more Bonds, is the one that came out in the April USNI proceedings. But he talks about influence squadrons. And you can kind of, you know, one of the things that he talks about and one of the uses you could have for these squadrons is because they're not all high-end assets, so to speak, they're better able to relate and have similar platforms to the Coast Guards and coastal navies of other countries that we would work with and also that we trade with. And you also mentioned earlier about the fact that the Coast Guard does deploy overseas and does regularly go into places. We even saw during the Russia-Georgia conflict that it was a Coast Guard cutter that went in there. Have you had a chance to look at Jerry's concepts and how the Coast Guard could play into that?
Yes. I'm a big fan of Jerry. He's got his book on Theodore Roosevelt and Great White Fleet, which I highly recommend to all listeners, available at Naval Institute Press. Jerry's right on the money. I love the U.S. Navy. My father was a commander, but, you know, their mission is power projection, and so many of the navies around the globe and Coast Guards can't relate to that, but they can relate to a white hull with a red racing stripe cutter from the United States Coast Guard. I mean, we are the Coast Guard is the perfect ambassador for the United States, and that's why it was the Coast Guard cutter at Dallas, like you mentioned, was sent to Georgia in August of 08 after the Russian-Georgia War. The skills of the theater security cooperation training that they bring is superb. And, I mean, I would build a lot more cutters just for that, you know, have two or three cutters 365 days a year in AFRICOMs, AOR, UCOM, PACOM, just doing theater security cooperation missions like Jerry mentions in his articles. I mean, talking about winning hearts and minds, and that's a great use for Coast Guard platforms, a great bargain for the U.S. Coast Guard. I mean, the Navy sent, like I believe it was about 2 or 3 years ago, a nuclear-powered submarine to train some navies in Africa. Well, I'm all for submarines, but how many nations in Africa can relate to a nuclear-powered submarine? So I'm all for building additional cutters just to influence the nations around the world.
Eagle One.
Well, Jim, I'm going to give you a magic wand, and if you could wave it in one direction, what would you wish on the Coast Guard?
A stimulus package of about $20 billion. To include probably an extra 8,000 reservists, another 40,000 active duty. The Commandant of the Coast Guard be made a statutory member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The Deepwater program accelerated and to include about 30 national security cutters, so that one, like I mentioned before, in addition to the 8 already planned, one can sail with every carrier strike group and expeditionary strike group. A robust Coast Guard history program. The Coast Guard Historian's Office is understaffed, and they could use a lot more people because the Coast Guard has a great history and heritage and just need help telling the story.
Jim, as you know, one of my favorite hobbies in life is being the contrarian, and I want to pick up a little nugget that you dropped earlier on in the show. And you mentioned icebreakers, and I've had a little bit of fun at the Navy's chief meteorologist, Rear Admiral Titley, because he kind of bought in with the whole the world is melting scenario. And, well, this year the sea ice is now back to what it has historically been. And I thought that was unfortunate because all you have to do is peel back one layer of the onion and see the absolutely critical shortfall as a nation that we have when it comes to icebreakers compared to what we had at the end of World War II, especially when you consider the fact from a national security standpoint, what little domestic oil that we produce is up in the Arctic. The Canadians and the Danes are getting fidgety about their claims in the Arctic, and Mother Nature has a way of doing what she wants to do. If you could, for a second, just elaborate a little bit on the importance that icebreakers have for us and why the Arctic, whether it's going to become a tropical paradise or it's going to have 1 kilometer deep ice next year, how critical that is to us in the nation and why we really don't look at it as much as we should.
Another good question, you guys. You guys ask better questions than a lot of the congressional hearings I attended over in my previous life. This nation, unlike the missile gap in the late 50s, early 60s, which was funny, we have a real gap. It's called the icebreaker gap. I mean, we had the Russia, the Danes, Canada, that have way far more icebreakers than we do. And giving our natural resources, like you mentioned, and the minerals under the sea, and just the flow of commerce, it's essential to our national security to have a much larger fleet of icebreakers. And the time for talking has been long over, and we just need to start building. And to save some time, I would recommend getting some plans off the shelf from another country and get a design that works so we don't have to, waste years and a lot of money on building something from scratch. Let's build something that has proven to work already, and we can catch up. But it's got to take a crisis before we do anything. And heaven forbid if the U.S. government's ever proactive too much.
And on that note, Jim, I think we can. We can call it a session. I appreciate you taking 30 minutes out of your time today to talk about the Coast Guard and its role in national security. And I think coming down the road, we need to spend a little more time talking about the Coast Guard because, again, when we get hit, not if it's got a maritime component to it, and, Jim, you know this better than I do, whoever is sitting in the number one seat in the Coast Guard is going to be sitting in front of a lot of representatives and a lot of senators answering some pretty good questions. And I just hope that we spent enough time spending that double budget in order to get there. Do you have anything you'd like to say as we close out, Jim?
As a close out, I just want to point out that the president's budget that was sent to the Hill this year, the Coast Guard was the only one out of the 5 service branches to have a budget, to have their budget cut. So hopefully the Congress, under their responsibilities to provide for an Army and Navy, will reverse that cut and increase Coast Guard spending.
Well, there's your exhibit one when they say, where the hell was the Coast Guard? Jim, thank you very much for MIDRAT. You got it. And everybody, just want to give you a heads up. You are listening to MIDRAT on Blog Talk Radio. I am Sal from the blog Commander Salamander. And with me is Eagle One from the blog Eagle Speak. Our second guest today is going to be Mark Stanovich. Mark is a lieutenant colonel in the United States Marine Corps Reserve. He's an artilleryman by training for over 22 years. He has served in all four Marine divisions and is a combat veteran of OIF-2. In his civilian occupation, he is an emergency planner in New England and is a qualified exercise developer who has participated in the planning and conduct of a myriad of federal and state exercises with scenarios ranging from natural disaster to terrorism to cyber attack. His current U.S. Marine Corps Reserve unit supports Title X war games for all the services. Mark, your return visitor, welcome back to MIDRATS.
Hey, thanks, Ben. How are you?
Doing quite well. So rumor has it you're in the bathtub right now. Is that a fact, or are you actually in a civilized location?
I'm actually in a civilized location for the time being. I'd like to point out to Jim that, yes, the Coast Guard's the only one that got its budget cut, but was also the only one that had its budget doubled since 9/11, so, you know, it's all relative.
It is.
Go ahead.
Hey, to lead things off, Mark, I kind of like to tee it up. We talked about the Coast Guard and Homeland Security, but once the inevitable happens, you know, the historians will talk about why it happened, but the absolutely critical need that takes place after that, you know, something some people refer to as consequence management, that's at the local level, whether it's nuclear, biological, chemical, or just something as deadly and primitive as jet fuel. When something happens and it's a mass casualty, people are going to look for their fire departments, they're going to look for their police, but more important than anything else, when you're in pain, you're going to be looking to your local medical center. What have we seen locally, especially when it comes to responding to mass casualties, which you would see in a terrorist attack on the homeland? How has that changed in the last 10 years, and where do you see where additional work really needs to go?
Well, let's say, obviously, post 9/11 and the creation of the Department of Homeland Security was a massive effort on a scale that probably had not happened since the expansion of the War Department in after Pearl Harbor. Specifically, what I should probably do is sort of tell you a story to answer your question. In a lot of these initiatives that have been put forward by the federal government, they have been actually fairly consistent in their theme. They essentially break down the four elements of homeland security into prevention, protection, response, and recovery. And I'll summarize some of those briefly because I think it's important to understand the context. The prevention of attacks, or obviously you don't prevent disasters that are natural or accidents, because that's why they call them accidents. But it's particularly with the prevention of terrorist attacks, the impetus there generally falls at the federal level. The trick to that is obviously the ability to rapidly share actionable intel with state and local entities that A, may not necessarily be cleared for that intel, and B, even if they are not in a position to do much about it, and C, even if they were, don't have the tools and equipment. As we get into protection, now we start having a little bit more shared responsibilities between the federal government and state and local. And the medical certainly falls into this. We have become familiar with what is known as the critical infrastructure protection concept. I've been happy to see that the feds have essentially set out what they believe are federal critical infrastructures, but have now passed it down to the state and local levels. Now, a regional hospital in a rural state, or even a suburban slash rural state such as New Hampshire, a large-scale hospital, a level one trauma center, is very much critical infrastructure for that state and that hospital's catchment area. That is something that is has really started to take a little bit of hold here, and I'm hoping, much the same as with the critical infrastructure protection at the federal level, that there'll be assets parsed, meaning money, parsed to the state and local governments to do the things that are needed to do to make sure that that hospital or whatever infrastructure is designated as critical infrastructure at that level is able to be protected and preserved. The last two of the steps are response and recovery. And it's at response, really, what you're talking about is the consequence management at the local level that really is a very, very difficult, very complex thing to have happen. Where are we now versus 9/11? Believe it or not, 9/11 in some ways happened in the aftermath of something called the Nunn-Lugar-Domenici Act, where there was the beginning of an initiative for rapid detection and reporting of biological, nuclear, radiological attacks. Several sets of medical response entities have been either created since then or were in the process of being created. Metropolitan Medical Response System, which is a way for hospitals to receive essentially surge help into an area that might be affected from an area that it's not necessarily as affected. The disaster medical assistance teams that would be federally deployed in the National Disaster Medical System to an affected area. All of those things are now in place and pretty solidly run. I mean, we saw them deployed actually down to Haiti, and as much as we had a lot of volunteers who just wanted to go down there to do something, it was the DMAT teams, the federal response teams, that really were the backbone of the U.S. Civilian response. And recovery, again, is that last step, and that is, once again, getting back more into the partnership between federal and state and local. There are some challenges with that, though. State and local governments, state and local businesses, because a great deal, if not the majority in many areas, of the tasks that are required to effect response and recovery to either a bioterror, nuclear attack, maybe an explosive attack, or a natural disaster, they come from the private sector. And even those that come from the public entities, they're taxpayer-funded. And there's only so much that can be borne in a readiness capacity. There's not a whole bunch of excess capacity at the state and local level, which means if there is something that is a very, very large incident, there's going to have to be help, and it's going to have to be help early. To answer your question, what's going on at the local level, we are looking at very serious talks about what we can do as local planners and state planners to allow for two things. One is to increase the amount of people that hospitals can render assistance to with the resources on hand. And the second is to have an influx of qualified physicians and just-in-time training volunteers who can aid the qualified clinicians in assisting as many people as possible. And that includes not just an influx of people, but a broadening of the facilities and resources available as well. There is something that was produced under HSPD 8 in 2003 called the Target Capabilities List. And in there is a list of capabilities that private hospitals are expected to have. And I'm not sure it's terribly well advertised, but in my role as a planner, that is sort of the backdrop with which I do a lot of the examination and assessment of the hospitals and the medical system that I deal with. So that's sort of a roundabout answer to your question. There is a number of things that have to still fall into place. Resources, of course, are always a challenge.
Eagle One.
As I understand the FEMA model, if there's an incident, the incident command starts at the local level, and then they call in help as they see that it's needed, which is one of the reasons I think that everybody gets frustrated that it takes FEMA so long to respond, because that's not really their mission. How, in the event of a major event, let's say a dirty bomb in New York City, or maybe New York City is a bad example, but in some place where normally they wouldn't expect that kind of activity, how is that going to work to get help promptly to the people who might need it?
Well, it's a challenge, and what you're referring to essentially is one of the things that I think was most misrepresented about Katrina was, yes, the federal government didn't exactly cover themselves with glory, but there were critical failures at the state and local level where the responsibilities of the initial incident management are supposed to take place that simply weren't done. Failing that, it will be a very difficult situation to try and retrieve. If there is something like a dirty bomb, a terrorist attack, you will see the feds in there quite early. You'll see a joint field office from the FBI into the area very quickly, and that will open up to federal assets. Now, if it is a disaster of a natural variety or even an accident, that's when you have the implementation of a disaster declaration or an emergency declaration under something known as the Robert T. Stafford Emergency Relief Act, known as the Stafford Act. In that case, it is the locals that will go to the governor of the state, and the governor of the state may declare a disaster or emergency at the state level for all of his state, part of his state, so forth. And if there is a situation where, and there are some obligations the governor has, the situation is beyond the state's ability to handle it, and he must be able to present that case to the director of FEMA, or at least his regional director, then he may make a request for a federal declaration. Now, that turns on a bunch of different things. It turns on the ability to get a great deal of help, both from a resource and a staffing standpoint, and it also turns on the money spigot. 75% of any incident response is covered, the ultimate cost of an accident or incident or disaster is covered by the federal government under the Stafford Act, and more if the remaining 25% is beyond the locality or state's ability to pay. That was one of the failures, I think, in Louisiana, was early in the incident when it looked like a landfall was going to hit the Louisiana coast. There was an opportunity to request that federal assistance under Stafford, and for whatever reason, it wasn't done. You know, that money, that ability to sign contracts to help with transportation entities and so forth is very critical, because the state and local resources, just they don't have that. It's not something that they keep on hand. They don't have the ability to maintain or staff a whole bunch of excess capacity. Will it be a slow process if there's something that happens in a rural area, like a Tier 2 or Tier 3 city or town? Yeah, it probably will be, but I suppose it's all relative. 72 hours when you are trying to get federal assets identified, flagged, coordinated, and moved seems like a blink of an eye. 72 hours when you're without food and water and you get people with critical injuries obviously seems like an eternity. So it's much more a matter of perspective, I guess. The state and local governments have been told that as best they can, that first 72 to 96 hours is for the garnering of state and local resources for the initial response and surge in of response and recovery capabilities. After that, if it's big enough, obviously we're going to see a gubernatorial request at the federal level for a disaster or emergency under Stafford.
Mark, when you open up the aperture a little bit, when you talk about the challenges of going federal to local coordination, as Europeans have found out this week, many times it's well beyond the national boundaries when something happens. You know, you got a volcano go off in Iceland, and the second and third order effects take place in a dozen nations way downwind with a greater impact than where it actually takes place. And when you look at possible consequent management challenges here in the U.S., especially if it's biological or radiological, depending upon where it takes place, we have Canada and Mexico, that those borders aren't going to obey what we may or may not want them to do when it comes to meeting the local needs after the incident takes place. In the exercise that you've been involved with and you've planned, how much interface have you had with the Canadians or the Mexicans, and are they really as focused on what potential impact could come on their end as we are?
Yeah, I think they quietly are. This is not something that is new. The exercises that I have both written and participated in and have facilitated both at the War College and elsewhere had a great deal of international component to it. Some of this is going to be essentially an establishment of a State Department hotline. This is sort of state's bailiwick. They're going to have to open the lines up so that people can have direct liaison authority to their counterparts in OCPEP or whatever the Canadian version is of Homeland Security. It used to be OCPEP. I'm not sure what it is now. They are as focused, and this is not something necessarily very new. They have a, particularly with things like biochem, this is biological weapons, by the way, is probably the brass ring for a really determined terrorist. That is a nightmare scenario if it is a virulent enough pathogen. A lot of this, believe it or not, it has already been done. A lot of what we're taking a look at now, and it's sort of like the teenager who thinks he discovered sex. We can dust off a lot of our Cold War plans for what would happen in a nuclear attack against the United States, and a lot of the concepts remain the same. You're going to have to repair damage to infrastructure, to move people out of affected areas, bring in massive amounts of resources to treat the wounded, decontaminate those who are contaminated, and bury the dead. That hasn't changed all that much since 1967. What has changed, in both for good and bad, is the mobility of the populations, and that's where the bioweapons can really, really open some eyes if you use some of the population migration models. It certainly scares the hell out of people with H5N1, and there are some others that would be quite a bit worse than that. So the Canadians and the Mexican governments are both pretty well aware of the impact that it would have. Now, how much control, particularly south of the border, those governments have on those regions is that's something we cannot control. Canada obviously is pretty stable, but with the recent activities in Mexico, all bets are off.
Eagle One.
Well, we started off this conversation with you discussing the fact that the Coast Guard had their budget doubled since 9/11. And I think what Jim said earlier was that a lot of that cost was eaten up by the additional expenses of medical TRICARE and things like that. What as a resource, if a highway is disturbed or whatever, we seem to use our rivers and stuff for help, like we did during 9/11, the Hudson River and the ferries and all that, getting people off Manhattan. Would not adding more money and ships and other assets to the Coast Guard be a benefit in Homeland Security preparation for disaster?
Yeah, I think it would. I think, I'm sort of tugging Jim's leg about that as I sit in this fancy hotel. But, I think it would. If we are really serious about the Coast Guard's mission being both influence projection and its traditional roles and that of the post-9/11 world, they are going to need far more than they have. And he's right. It was a 30-year holiday in between commissionings of hulls. And Fib, I think it was your point. You know, I'm looking at this obviously from the outside. I've never been in the Coast Guard, but the Tiffany's vessels in the driving up of costs so that we could hang every last toy and trinket on it has really had an adverse effect, particularly on them, or at least we'll have a chance to, far more even than the Navy because of their limited size. What we need is essentially some pretty straightforward stuff as far as I can tell. And I'm stunned to hear that it would take us 10 years to design an icebreaker. It's an icebreaker. How long have we been breaking ice with steel hulls in the North Passages? So you're right, Eagle. I think it would be a wise thing to increase the pledge of the United States Coast Guard for that purpose. And, you know, I also want to add this, too. One of the Coast Guard's strongest points that I could see is I saw some of the harbor security, port security missions evolving is as an information fusion center. Their abilities to fuse information and maintain situational awareness have always been quite good. Now they're going to have to be better. Whatever we can put through that pipeline toward that, for an increase in that capability, I think would get my vote.
Yeah, your comment about 10 years to design and build a cutter—that's I was kind of thinking along the same lines that we've kind of lost something when we can't do something that's mission specific, but not really an aircraft carrier as a cutter, as a icebreaker. What I want to throw at you this time is from the political side of the house, when I look at Congress and I look at the Senate and the Navy issue comes up, I can look at the list of congressmen and senators and I know where those critical points are. That congressman, that senator, this one's really powerful, doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. This one knows it real well, but he's not in the right committee. Same thing with the Coast Guard. They pretty much know who are their subject matter experts, for lack of a better phrase. When it comes to homeland security and consequence management, I have trouble getting a handle around who in Congress really are the power players that you want to go to for these issues. And I kind of wanted to roll that in to a question that our buddy Claude Barabé asked, and that was, there used to be a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Crisis Management and Defense Support of Civil Authorities. That position more or less has been eliminated by the Obama administration. Are you familiar with that? What reason there may have been for that? And was that a good move? Did they just change the title, or is it something that got lost in the shuffle?
Well, I think it's probably a little of both. I mean, those duties have got to go someplace. DISCA, the Defense Support of Civilian Authorities, is a complex mission. That is not something that is terrifically straightforward. There are a great deal of limitations under Stafford and under Posse Comitatus that forbid the Defense Department from doing certain things and taking certain actions that do have to be carefully coordinated. You know, there are some state governors that will tell you, yes, Mr. President, that's all well and good, but unless this is a terrorist incident of national significance, you don't put Title 10 Boot 1 on my dirt until I tell you to. And that is within the state's purview. I guess I would tell you that I see the elimination of the DISCA in the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Consequence Management positions as a larger issue of a somewhat inconsistent understanding of what the Defense Department's role may have to be. Certainly from the standpoint of response and recovery to a use of a WMD weapon, that is not something that is a collateral duty. That is something that is going to require not only the manpower or staffing power to physically do the work of the planning and in the coordination, but also have the authority to be able to direct traffic as the Secretary of Defense deems it appropriate. to not have that specifically in there. I guess I would feel better if I saw a model without those two positions where I see those clear authorities still extant. I have not seen that yet. Until I do, it causes me some concern. How's that for a sort of political answer?
You've got a future in politics if you could just pretty yourself up some. Eagle One.
Well, I was going to say that a lot of the elimination of the person at DOD doesn't seem to make that much difference, since much of the liaison is done at the state level with the military rep normally assigned to each state government. Have you seen that work in the past?
Yeah, I have. I think, though, if you leave it on the state rep's shoulders, you are severely limiting the size of the federal response. If we have a no-kidding regional incident, we have multiple detonations of a jacketed device up and down the eastern seaboard, you could have people with contamination issues from Providence, Rhode Island to Jersey City, New Jersey, instantly. I've got to tell you, that ain't going to be something that the state liaisons are going to be able to handle. The coordination of the sending of the Department of Defense resources to that area is going to have to essentially be done at the federal level. And without that DISC of person, I don't know if it has gone away, but I don't see where it exists currently.
Mark, one final question for you here, kind of something that we threw the way of Jim. If you could get a line put in the next congressional budget to give you a boost for consequence management, what would it be?
Well, that's a harder question than the Coast Guard. My guess would be that I would be looking to have the ability to have state-owned, state-possessed stockpiles of critical equipment that could be maintained with state staffing and resources, but funded federally. Getting things like gowns, masks, gloves from the federal government in the Strategic National Stockpile distribution was not necessarily all that we wanted it to be for H1N1. I think that if we had something like that, and it, you know, it's certainly not going to be comprehensive, but something that would allow for, based on what the state's hazard analysis would be, what they would consider the appropriate amount and type of equipment to have on hand that is more than just a cursory fill in the gap until the feds get here. But you know, I'm not sure we can do that in a cost effective manner, frankly. State governments, like federal governments, are not profit making ventures. Whenever they have something like that into their control, the possibility is very strong that it's going to have abuse, misuse, and neglect sap the potential of whatever it is that was originally proposed.
And of course, there's always the intangible ingredient in any type of emergency we have, and that's the right leadership, and we can't put that in a line. Well, Jim, we're kind of running out of time here. Correction, Mark, we're running out of time. But I wanted to thank both you and Jim for coming on today. And enjoy your hotel room stay where you are. And thank you very much for coming on Mid-Rats.
Well, I appreciate it. And I want to just tell you that I was told that I must tell you Mary Ripley is awesome. And she is indeed. But thank you guys very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I didn't know that you were wearing a shock collar right now. But anyway, who could disagree with that? Thanks again, everybody who's listening to us live, or you get us on the archive, and for those who came in for the chat room and helped feed us some good questions. I want to remind everybody we're going to be back again at our same day and time next week. Next week, we're going to kind of look back and then where we're going moving forward. Our two guests, our first one will be retired Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel J.G. Jim Zumwalt, who will be on to talk about his new book on Vietnam, Bare Feet and Iron Will. And then after him, we're going to have journalist Greg Grant to come on to discuss some of the conversations that you've heard online and in print media about some of the realistic fleet options that we're going to have in 2020. So keep an eye on my and Eagle One's blog, Twitter, and Facebook feeds for details as the week goes forward. Thank you very much, and have a great Navy Day.
Malone wants to marry me, and so leave the strand. And